because I don't know, it's a fiscal year.
That's their fiscal year.
Yes. See, my charges were in the first 6 months of 82. So when they said this would correct the immediate past year, the people who now got their rate increases in December, that was not true. The unemployment department, I understand, has said they cannot, will not, won't, I don't know, do 1981. My understanding is that the Senate of this state is running this state, and you have been elected to make the laws to fairly treat the citizens of this state. And I absolutely believe in the American system, and I am here because, and I spent a year because I believe you can operate in the system and correct an injustice. Now, I feel that the Senate should do the right thing and tell the employees and the Bureau of Unemployment to do it, period. And that's what I asked
them. Do you know what reason they gave why they couldn't use
that? Oh, well, they would have to.
Cost too much money.
Oh, they can't recompute the computer. I mean, you know how they are. They can't. It's going to cost a fortune. We can't do the computer. Heavens above, the computer runs the Bureau. And I reject this. I reject this out of hand. There are people and sisters that say, A, I am a damn fool to be paying all these taxes. There are a lot of people who don't, small businesses that pay under the table. I want to pay my taxes. I want to pay fair taxes. I want to pay what I owe. And I want my rate of 2% back. And I guess basically that's why I'm here.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your persistence in calling this problem.
I'd be glad to answer any questions if anybody had any.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Zirkle? Thank you very much. Mr. John McCulley, Small Business Advocate.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm with Small Business Advocates. I'm here in support of House Bill 2653. I think that Nancy Zirkle has adequately explained the problem, because it is indeed a problem and does strike small employers, I guess all employers, as being very unfair to be having your unemployment account charged when you have someone still working for you. And that's why we do support this legislation. And I really do want to say...
do you have any comments on those amendments that Senator Hamby had proposed? Or?
Those amendments, just for your information, were proposed on the House side, or that situation was brought up to the members on the House Labor Committee. And they chose at that time not to deal with them. We do support those ideas.
I guess I'm kind of concerned about what impact it would have on the bill if we, in terms of its lifespan, yeah. If we added that in this particular vehicle.
That I can't answer, since the House Labor Committee
chose not to.
You know, that might have an impact, although they were interested and were concerned about that problem. But they, as I say, chose not to do anything. I do want to put on the record the fact that I have worked very closely with the Employment Division on this bill from its initial, I guess, hearing in the House Labor Committee, because as initially drafted, it would not have, at least in our feelings, accomplished what needed to be accomplished. And they spent many hours working to take care of the conformity problems and to assure us that this bill would indeed accomplish what we were seeking. As far as the June 30th, 1982 date goes, I'm sure the Employment Division will be able to comment on that better than I as to why that date was chosen rather than 1 year earlier, because there are, as I understand, some serious administrative problems that would be encountered by doing that. And I know that doesn't solve Mrs. Zirkle's problem, but that is something I'm sure the Employment Division can clarify for you. But I just wanted to make sure the record shows that the Employment Division has worked very closely with us and very diligently on at least developing a piece of legislation that we think is going to be workable. One other thing, I have submitted to you a proposed amendment to the bill that I have been asked to submit on behalf of the Small Business Advisory Committee to the Department of Economic Development. The amendment simply states that when adopted, this act is added to and made a part of the Oregon Small Business Development Act of 1983. That was Senate Bill 776, which the Senate passed, I think it was last week. This is a policy statement that says really how important small business is to the state of Oregon. The advisory committee to the Department of Economic Development has selected a list of bills that they feel are important to small business in the state, and House Bill 2653 is one of those, and would request that this amendment be added as a part of that bill for reference purposes only to the Small Business Development Act.
I guess I'm a little confused, John. You want Senate Bill, you don't actually want to put into Senate Bill 776.
No.
You just want a statement saying this is part of that package or part of that. I guess we have to maybe change the language.
I was involved in 776, and if you recall, all that did was it made a statement concerning small business, and the idea is to put, when enacted, to put these various
policy
changes
in one place
into
in
one
the statute.
Chapter of the statutes. And this would just place this language into that statute along with the other ones.
Okay.
Or sort of a marketing tool.
Okay, it would just be a reference in another part of the statute that this unemployment tax relief to small businesses is part of that policy.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Does this require an amendment to the bill?
Yeah, we probably would have to send it down to Legislative Council and get it.
Yeah, Legislative Council has given us this language. This language is from Legislative Council.
Okay, I think we'll have to get some assistance in terms of how we engraft it in this particular
certainly
bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
thank
any
you
questions for Mr. McCauley?
Well, other than a comment, you know, I think it's a real good idea. It'll save a minimum of paperwork in this effort. We could put it all on one page, triple space.
Okay. Mr. Cross.
For the record, my name is Bill Cross with the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association, and I just wanted to echo our support on this bill. A number of restaurant operators do employ part-time employees, and this would be a significant help to a number of them.
So they're experiencing the same problem that
yes
Zirkle complained of.
I might add, Madam Chair, that this is not as a unique a problem as one might think, because there are many, many instances that we've become aware of just since the bill was introduced. Senator Kitzhaber has a constituent who has this problem. I know Senator Hurd and Representative Agrons have a constituent who runs a skating rink who has this problem. So it is fairly common among a lot of small business people who do hire part-time workers.
And we want to encourage them to keep hiring people.
That's right.
Okay. Senator Waters, do you have a question?
I had an employer contact me with a problem somewhat like this where being a small employer, just laid off one person and had a huge increase in his rate. And he was wondering why he had a good go around with the employment people and determined that they said that it would be difficult to go back farther. He'd been an employer in Oregon for over 20 years, and he had only laid one person off or something, two people in that whole period. But his rate was based on the last 3 years. Is it 3 years?
Correct.
Have you researched that? Would that be something we could possibly extend back without destroying something vital? It seems like people who've been having a business in Oregon for 10 or 20 years, we should try and honor that commitment and not hit them with a very high rate when they lay off one person.
Senator Waters, I would be interested in researching that to see how we might be able to work out something like that with the Employment Division. The thing that I always get when I talk to the Employment Division is, yes, we can make certain changes in how we compute those rates, but understand that when you give relief to someone, someone else is going to pay more. And I guess what
sort
we have to determine
tax
is where, yeah,
giving an exemption
is, you know, where that line occurs. And you know what you're saying is seems like a fair approach, and I'd be happy to look into it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We now have the Employment Division, Libby Leonard and Roger Lent here, and they could I guess, address the issues raised in the amendment and also that date that concerns Ms. Zirkle. And anything else you want to add on the bill?
Madam Chairperson, I'm Libby Leonard, Deputy Administrator of the Employment Division. I can't address this in any manner that you choose. I could respond to some of the comments of Ms. Zirkle on the date. One issue is the date of should it be 1982 or should it be prior to that. What is your choice of how we proceed?
Well, I think the committee would like to help Ms. Zirkle out if we could in terms of changing that date. I understand, but I'd like to know what the ramifications are of changing that date. Her testimony was that you opposed changing that date, so I'd like to know why you did.
In her testimony, she said that we refused to do it. We certainly have not refused, and will not refuse to take any date that the legislature applies in the law. The reason that 1982 was chosen is that the tax rates that will be based upon from that time forward will not go into effect and will not be operated under until 1984. If we go back a year prior to that, then you're talking about tax rates which are already in effect in 1983. And Once you start moving backwards like that, there will be employers who would have been affected in 1980 and 1979. We did have a part-time relief of charges in the law, which was taken out of the law in 1977. So since 1977 session, there have undoubtedly been employers who have been affected by the lack of this type of relief of charges in the law. So our purpose in saying that it would be best administratively, because there would be no actual retroactivity for actual usage of a tax rate, to go back to 1982. There are various bills before this body.
What would be the effect if we change it to 1981, if we amended the bill, in terms of the impact on the fund or on your office?
I think I'll let Roger Lind, who is a tax manager, answer that.
Yeah, if you have any estimates about how many people might be applying for retroactive relief, then.
Madam Chair, my name is Roger Lind. I'm with the Employment Division. Basic concern, I think, with the going back to 1981 or earlier, is it does set up a situation where it changes tax rates and it provides a retroactive refund or utilization again of the tax against the future taxes. Another thing.
Is it the kind of issue we got into that musician's bill, where you're setting a precedent for retroactive relief? Is that what you're concerned about, or?
That's one of the concerns, yes. Another thing that we, whenever we set this up for, or the July 1st date, whenever we compute our array, at least these employers, as we compute our tax rates on June 30th of each year for the following year's tax rates. And the way this is set up at the present time, that we will be sending out tax rate notices with a notification if the bill should pass, that they should notify us of any part-time relief, and we'll go in and make adjustments for the 1984 rates.
So how this is going to work is their relief comes as a credit to their rates?
Well, at least in 1984, we'll have a chance. We go in and adjust the rates before the rates go into effect.
What I want to know is, this says, I want to know how this is going to work. It says the amendments say it goes into effect will not charge this benefit the employer's account. In other words, are they going to get credit on their future for overpaying, or how is this going to work?
They will receive credit for the relief of charges.
Okay.
As of July 1st, 1982, which we can adjust their 1984 rate prior to that rate going into effect.
Well, I don't see if you're going to give relief and credit, why you can't just put 81 then?
No, if there would be no... there would be credit for relief of charges, yes. There would not have been an overpayment, because when you use the 1982, the tax rate under which they will be operating starting in January of 84 is the one that's affected. And what I was saying before is if you go back and make it retroactive one more year, the tax rate under which a person has been operating and paying taxes in 1983, this is already in effect, and taxes have been paid under a rate so far this year and will be for the rest of this year. If you go back to 1981, then you're affecting and perhaps causing overpayments by the employer if you grant more relief retroactively, which would cause us to have to make adjustments and could affect not only that employer's rate, but contiguous employers' rates. When you array all the employers from the very lowest to the very highest in experience, what you do to one affects others.
I'm sure it will. I mean, that's how effective it is, that if you're, for the employers that aren't laying people off, they should get lower rates, and the ones that are laying people off should get higher rates.
Yes, but if the one thing that, and I think John McCulloch mentioned it, the one thing that I have to keep in mind, and I hope that the committee will keep in mind, is that none of what we're talking about affects how much money we pay out in benefits. So you have this great big amount of money going out in benefits, and it all has to be paid for out of the trust fund, generally, except for reimbursable employers. What you do within that trust fund to charge one employer or another employer means that if one gets a little bit of a break here, another one pays a little more. And it isn't always because it's one person's fault and it isn't the other employer's fault. If you put everybody down at a lower rate, in order to pay the total volume that goes out, they'll all have to be moved up. The rates will have to be moved up.
We're not talking about moving everyone. We're talking about, well, the bill is talking about people who have not laid anybody off, but they do have part-time people who somebody else has laid off.
That's true.
Senator Hanby's amendments are talking about an employer who has good cause. So we're not talking about everybody. We're talking about specific, which will be some percentage of the trust fund.
You're absolutely right. You're talking about specific targeted groups of people who have done certain things to cause them not to perhaps deserve relief of charges. All I'm trying to say is that when you relieve charges, they still have to be paid for someplace. And that means that if everybody gets relief of charges, then everybody's rates go up.
Okay. Obviously, some other people's rates are going to go up if we give these people. I think we do understand that. But did you prepare for the House Labor Committee any kind of fiscal analysis of what that means? Or?
Well, now, are we talking? You have two issues before you this morning. One would be the relief of charges for part-time workers,
right,
going back to 82, or with Mrs. Urkel's testimony, going back to 81. The impact statement on that was negligible. It would be a small one-time shot at the fund to go back to 1982.
Did you prepare an impact statement going back to 1981?
The impact on the entire fund I'm talking about. There's no way we can tell you how each individual employer would be impacted, but the ones that are going to get relief would be impacted favorably.
Senator Kitzhaber?
I think I understand that if you were to relieve these individuals who have an inappropriately high rate, that there would be a commensurate elevation of rates somewhere else in the system. But if you hadn't push the rates of these people up in the first place, wouldn't the other rates have been a little higher? Aren't the other rates a little lower because you pushed these rates up?
That'd be a fair statement.
Yes, it would.
Yeah, I think that would be a fair statement.
Well, it seems to me then you're not the other place in the system where the rates are going up. Those people have benefited by the error, if you want to call it that. So I don't see that there's any, if you look at the whole system as a whole, there's any inequity.
Senator Kitzhaber,
sure,
I think...
probably oversimplifying it there.
I think one of the points that should be realized in that line of thinking is that the people that benefited by that lower tax rate, by the people that with a part-time relief had the higher tax rate. But the people that enjoy the lower tax rate should in actuality been higher. What we do when we compute tax rates, we develop an array of people according to their benefit cost ratio, and we list them from their lowest rate to the highest rate, and then they have a cumulative payroll, which has certain breaks. And when we get into the breaks is where the discrepancy in the tax can occur, whether you're going to get a 2.6 or 2.7.
So you push some people across the break line. It shouldn't have been. Or you drop some people under one of those. And you just push them back if you relieve their problem.
Well, what we would do, it could very well relieve their problem and move them down. But in the overall fund picture, where we're supposed to have a certain amount of money in the fund, we take into consideration a number of factors. In this particular case, we took their particular benefit cost ratio as existed and arrayed it with the rest of the employers. And as a result of theirs, we do something with their benefit cost ratio or whatever, and we go back and look at the total array, it could change where our breaks are. Again, I just re-emphasize, change where the breaks are depending on whether or not you have the 0.1% tax rate difference.
I guess perhaps what Roger is saying, and perhaps what the point I was trying to make is that the impact on the trust fund total dollars would be negligible. The division has no objection to this bill. We did have an objection to going further back than 1982 because of the retroactivity and the changing of tax rates that are already in effect. And we do that with after discussions with the governor on retroactive bills in general in this, you mentioned, Madam Chairperson, the musicians bill. The governor is opposed to retroactivity that changes.
Are you delivering us another veto message?
No, I am not. I am just saying is why we use 1982 as the date when we were asked to develop this language. But it is a question on the fund. If you lower a number of charges, what you do is probably at some point, and I don't know where that point would be, raise or limit the number of people that are going to get the minimum rate, because the rate has to be high enough to pay for all the benefits paid out.
I think we all understand that. Okay. Senator Hannon.
Libby, you used 1982. What year is the rate established for the future? In other words, how far in advance is the rate established?
The 3-year experience ending in June of 82, for instance, establishes the rate for 1980 calendar year 1983.
Okay, now Mrs. Zirkle's claim came in the first 6 months of 1982. So really going back to 1981 would still not take care of her problems. She'd probably have to go back to 1980.
No, if her claim, if her charges were in the first part of 82,
I wouldn't put it into 80s.
And this law were in effect at that time, as a retroactive clause would do, then her recount would have been relieved of charges for that period, and she would not show that in her experience rating.
Thank you very much.
For this year, her taxes in 1983. Yeah.
Okay. Why can't this be handled administratively rather than creating a statutory problem of taking in and encompassing all these other people? Now, you indicate that we're opening Pandora's box if we go back to take care of Mrs. Zirkle's problem. But what kind of statutory language would you provide that you could take care of Mrs. Zirkle's problem and take care of these other problems on an individual basis rather than opening up this whole rate structure. Let's talk about it that way. You design the language. We're asking you to do something that statutorily you say you can't do, so you provide the language to us and show us how to do it.
Well, in response, Senator, the best I could suggest, and we have worked closely with a number of people in drafting this language, to address Mrs. Zirkle's problem, I agree with her that the date of 1982 would have to be changed to 1981. And that can be done. But what it will do will be to change the tax rates that are in effect in 1983. They're already in effect. It will change her tax rate and it would change other tax rates for employers with similar problems. And there are employers with these problems. We hear from them as well as probably you hear from your constituents. And there have been complaints.
Now, you just indicated a little bit ago that the effect is negligible.
The effect of the bill as amended by the House is negligible. The effect, if you change the date to 1981, becomes larger. As a fiscal monetary effect, I can't tell you what it would be. I doubt if it would be a drain on the unemployment fund. I don't think it would at all. I'm not saying that. It would mean that tax rates in effect now would be changed. If there would be enough change to cause a change in the tax schedule, I don't know. Depends on how many people ask for relief.
Okay. Can you give us an idea what the number of employers coming in seeking relief would be? Is it 20 or 100, 1,000, or can you give us a number?
I don't know. In the bill as drafted for part-time relief, there are some changes from the prior law that we operated under prior to 1977. We did not have a great many people seeking this relief prior in when that law was in effect up until the 1977 session. I have the feeling, and it's strictly a feeling, that there are more part-time workers in the economy today than there had been in the past. It may be the type of economy we're in. I don't know. Because we are receiving more complaints on this subject. There's no doubt about that.
Well, it still boils down to the fact that we're going to have to do something to allow it to go on and not make corrections only compounds the problem that much more out into the future. So we have to either say this is it and retroactively go back to correct the problem, or we are really going to create a future nightmare down the road here within 2 to 3 years.
Well, the House bill as amended with the date of 1982 would be retroactive only in the sense of we would go back and relieve some charges that have probably already been applied. It would not be retroactive on tax rates for employers. And the division has no opposition to this bill at all. I'm really trying to...
Well, maybe we can get to the bottom line here. Say we change the date to June, to the date requested by the person that inspired the bill. And so you are going to have to change your rates. Some employers are going to have higher rates. Some are going to have lower rates. We don't know how many, apparently, or you don't know how many. What would be the bottom line? I wasn't kidding, but are you saying the governor would veto the bill if we did that?
I have not talked to the governor, nor has Ray Thorne, on this specific bill or that specific amendment. I merely mentioned that because that had been a matter of discussion on other bills where retroactive provisions were provided.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just one other question. Libby, could we use 1982 as the year to roll back, but provide one other exception for those particular cases that where the employers would come in to appeal to go back to 81.
Well, actually, that's what you're doing in the law as written up in the House amendments, where it says 1982. The employer has to come in and ask for the relief of charges. So if you just change the date to 1981, it would be the same thing. The employer would still have to come in and ask. The employer would be notified that such an opportunity existed for him to ask for relief, and would come in then and ask at his volition.
It's not possible to create a window?
That might be a good idea. Get so much time. Couldn't have that be an impact on shifting the rates?
In other words, if we were to, in mailing out notices this, what is it, November, Roger?
November 15th.
In mailing out notices November 15th, say, you've only got a window now anyway. You get your notice and you've got 20 days to ask for relief. If you had part-time workers that we were
receiving an independent review of the referee's decisions. In 1959, the legislature created an independent agency to administer the unemployment insurance program and simultaneously created an independent agency to review the decisions of the other agency's referees. Due to some of the current statutory language and authority, there still remains some doubt that the Employment Appeals Board is not truly independent of the control of the Employment Division. This perception is a result of Employment Division's authority to enact rules governing the board, even though they have not made any attempt to do so. The authority is there. And also on the control of the budget. And so that we've clarified that with them and through the governor's office, and we have no more problem with the budget control. We do not view this bill as creating any substantial changes in the way in which the law should be interpreted. The bill's only purpose is to remove all of the doubt about whether the board is an independent quasi-judicial review body, and to prevent future misinterpretation of the law or misconceptions of what our role is. We would ask as well, Madam Chairperson, that questions relating to the agency's changes that are asked in this bill, that we asked Libby Leonard to be allowed to comment on those as well. Tom O'Connell is our executive secretary, and he will go through the bill in any detail to the extent that you want to go.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator O.
General questions. For my information, could you give me the present makeup of the board now?
Jerry Butler, Staten Canning, represents management. Pat Randall is the labor member, and by the way, these are specified by law. And I, Ross Morgan, am the public member.
Do all three of you concur in these?
With this bill?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Tom O'Connell, Executive Secretary, Employment Appeals Board. I'd like to deal with these, just go through the sections very briefly, if I may.
Well, I have some real concerns about them, so I hope you don't go through too briefly.
Very well. Section 1 is an amendment to the existing law that Mr. Morgan spoke about regarding correction of common errors to be allowed to be made by the Employment Division. Employment Division personnel are present and are undoubtedly better qualified to testify to those amendments in Section 1. Section 2.
All right. I do have a question about Section 1, so who do I direct that to? On page 2 in subsection 4 of Section 1 in the new boldface, presently, if a decision, I understand that the board had made a ruling that when you issue a benefit, that is a decision, is that correct? And is this to undo that ruling? In other words, if you issued a benefit, you would not have to give notice. Is that what the effect of this is? For other purposes, if you reconsider the decision on granting a benefit?
I'm Chairperson Libby Leonard, Deputy Administrator of the Employment Division. What we have run into recently is I think the same thing you're saying. Our referees and I believe the board will have to correct me on this, have said that if we issue a benefit check, that is a decision and can only be amended through continuous jurisdiction taken by the administrator. What this means is that if for some reason we find that, for instance, in fraud investigations, we never, when we do a cross match of wages and benefits paid, we're looking at a period 6 or 8 months prior. We may find that somebody did in fact fraudulently draw benefits, and we would set up an overpayment for benefits that were paid. What they're saying is that the fraud investigator can't issue that decision. Ray Thorne or his designee has to issue it. So what we're saying is that a decision to issue a check is not a final decision of the type described in that has already been described in the law.
So then there would be no statute of limitations as far as the claim is concerned.
Well, no, there wouldn't be a statute of limitations. Now, we would never go back and set up an overpayment without an investigation in which the claimant was a part and a hearing process that the claimant can use.
Well, what, obviously, you had a concern. Is this amendment the result of that decision that the board came down with? Why do you need this
amendment? Yeah, we can't figure out any other way to operate the way we had for years until this thing arose, where if we found through proper investigative channels that for some reason a week that had already been paid should not have been paid, our hands are pretty tied right now, and that we can't go back and change that to set up an overpayment unless we go through an administrative monstrosity of causing the administrator to have to take continuous jurisdiction.
But then, does this allow you to order an overpayment without a due process hearing?
Oh, no. There is no way that we can set up an overpayment without a hearing appeals notice. Anytime we deny benefits for any week whatsoever, whether it's for a week that hasn't been paid yet or whether it would be retroactive to go back to a week that had been paid and set up an overpayment, the person always has a written decision and a right of appeal.
Okay, but it says any decision which does not require notice may be amended at any time by the authorized representative.
Right.
Now, is that allowed to be amended without notice to the person?
No. Any decision which does not require notice would be that we have just paid a check. We had no reason to suspect that there was any reason for an investigation of eligibility. We just took a claim. Somebody said, yes, I want my unemployment, and we paid it because nothing had come to our attention that there was any reason to question it. Then we find a week or 2 weeks, or in the case of fraud investigators, 6 months later, that person, in fact, should not have been paid for that week, was not eligible. We now have evidence of that, whatever it might be.
Okay, under present law, do you have a time limit in which you must make that decision?
No, we did not have until until a ref, some referees' decisions said that once you issue that check, you have made a decision and it becomes final in, I guess they're saying 20 days. Is that what you're getting from those decisions?
The time within which it becomes final has not been determined, but what they have done is, and what the board has done, is under the language of subsection 4 of ORS 657-265, the word decision is used when a check is paid. And to amend that decision, the procedure established under 657-290 must be followed.
So, but what the net effect of that is then is, under that ruling, then, if you issue a check and you grant a check, then you would have to have a time limit that you'd have to follow if you're going to amend that decision. In other words, you couldn't go on indefinitely and then come around 6 months later and say, unless you use the fraud statute or something. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. Is your question to the changes proposed for
the
law?
Yeah, I'm saying, obviously, you're responding to this ruling by your referees, apparently, that if you issue a check, that's a decision, and that the claimant then has some due process rights that they hadn't had before, apparently, in terms of the time limits. Is that correct, or is it incorrect?
Madam Chair, Tom O'Connell, this amendment, and following the situation that has been described, if a check has been paid, a decision has been made. Now, there is no formal written decision required under those circumstances. The amendment addresses itself to that situation where no formal decision is published and served on the party, but a check is issued. Now, if it is determined at a later date that for one reason or another that check should not have been issued, then this would allow the Employment Division to issue a formal decision that is subject to all of the appeal rights of any other written decision served on the party, saying that those weeks which were paid should not have been paid, and then the person, of course, is afforded all of their due process rights.
Okay, how does this bold-faced language differ from what you would do now under that circumstance?
I can't speak for the division, but it would allow them, when just a common, if you will, bonehead error is made someplace in the process, to go back and correct that one way or the other. At the present time, it's administratively and nearly impossible for them to take care of these situations, and this would allow corrections to be made where errors had occurred in the process.
I'd mention it works both ways, Madam Chairperson. They might also get paid. It isn't just a case of denying benefits. There are many times an error is made the other direction, and a claimant very well may get paid that was not being paid.
Well, Mr. Morgan, I think, is getting into Section 5, and he's very, very right on that. But on the one we're talking about, it would not, they would have had a written decision if they'd been denied benefits. Tom is correct that what has happened is, we send out, right now we're sending out, about 50,000 checks a week. And we never, in all the time that I've been with the division, considered each of those checks to be a formal decision. True, you had to decide to pay the benefits. Well, you do that in a very, very short period of time. You look at a certification somebody assigned saying, yes, I didn't work last week, and yes, I was looking for work, and you put it in the computer and you pay a check. You don't sit down with an interview on each one of these and make a formal decision. Well, at about a year or so ago, our referees, in reading this section of law, subsection 4, came to the conclusion that we were making a decision, quote unquote, every time we issued a check. And therefore, all of those decisions were could not be changed except by the administrator taking continuous jurisdiction. We could not go back and say, oops, we goofed, we shouldn't have paid this person last week. What we had always done, if we found we overpaid somebody and shouldn't have paid them, was issue at that point a formal decision saying, you're denied and we're setting up an overpayment and we'll take it out of a future check. This change to the law gives us the authority to do that, to look back, find a reason why they shouldn't have been paid, if such appears to us, and issue a formal decision to deny that week and set up an overpayment. Which decision would be appealable?
Could I ask if you would submit to the committee a copy of that referee's opinion that made the ruling?
Probably have a number of them. Yes, we will. And we have a board of at least one, possibly more board decisions.
Several.
Okay, maybe I get a referee opinion and a board decision. I'd like to see the reasoning in that.
It's particularly, Madam Chairperson, impacting the fraud program, where we have fraud investigators who have always written decisions which set up overpayments, which give appeal rights, where at many, many times the claimant admits fraud, and now the referees and the board are saying the fraud investigators do not have jurisdiction to write those decisions.
I'd like to see those opinions.
I'll find them for you.
Okay. Why don't we proceed through the bill?
Madam Chair, Tom O'Connell. Section 2 deals with ORS 657.275, and it was determined a change in this section of the law was necessary because of the confusion that surrounded the issue of whether an employment division referee may enter a new decision when a case is remanded by the Employment Appeals Board. This change clarifies the referee's authority and makes it possible and allows a referee to enter a new decision under those circumstances. The deletion of the language at page 3, line 5, is to eliminate the confusion we've had for years. How much time is allowed to petition the Court of Appeals? This is related to Section 4 and ties in with that. The current law provides that a decision must be issued within 30 days from the filing of an appeal. It has been impossible to comply with this requirement in all cases since approximately 1975 because the workload has been too high, and therefore the preparation of transcripts that the board must review takes longer. That restriction on the time within which a decision must be issued has been unworkable and has not been able to be complied with. In the event of passage of this bill, the board would adopt a rule requiring that 80% of all of its decisions be decided within 45 days and 90% within 60 days. In Section 3, there's a simple deletion of two words, and appeals, and that relates to the board enacting its own procedural rules, which is dealt with in Section 9. Section 4 of the bill is a clarification of the total time within which to petition the Court of Appeals. It always has been 30 days, but that was split up 10 days in one statute, 20 days in another. Now it's all incorporated in one statute. Section 5, which is on page 3, is in conjunction with Section 1, and that is the allowing the division to correct the errors that has pretty well been covered, and we concur in this, as was stated before. Section 6, the changes there are in accordance with the board being able to adopt its own procedural rules and some corrections made by legislative counsel. Section 7, again, regards the board adopting procedural rules and contains some more corrections by legislative counsel. Section 8 is mostly corrections by legislative counsel and amends the language consistent with the board making its own rules. Section 9, the last section in the bill, provides that the Employment Appeals Board chairperson may appoint pro tem members with approval of the governor. This was considered necessary to deal with the absence of any board member during periods of high workloads. As matters now stand, the Employment Appeals Board would be unable to function if there were a prolonged absence of one member and the remaining two are in disagreement. Those cases would then have to be set over for indeterminate periods until the absent member returned, delaying any decision.
Wouldn't there be a question if a person was absent that long, whether or not they should continue serving?
There may be, but that would be up to the governor who makes the appointments. Should the workload increase substantially over what it was in January and February of this year, it may be necessary to temporarily increase the number of board members for a period not to exceed 90 days to prevent a serious backlog of cases.
No, those aren't subject to Senate confirmation.
They are not.
They are. Well, no, it says except for the pro tempore, the appointments are subject to confirmation by the Senate.
Right. Oh, the board members are set, but pro tems are not.
Pro tems.
No. And therefore, the limit of 90 days serving.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
The language here that I see what you're trying to do, but I just wonder if you want the word may or should not be shall. You have the chairperson may appoint with the approval of the governor pro tem members. It just makes it an optional type of thing.
Yes, it is discretionary.
And what if he doesn't?
Then apparently there would be no need for it if they
What if the chairperson's the one that's gone?
Yeah. Well, that's the next point.
Then I suppose it would be incumbent upon the remaining two members to approach the governor. Continuing with that section, it grants to the chairperson more authority than the chairperson currently has in order to administer the function of the board, and this amendment was made at the suggestion of the governor's office. And the last item confers upon the board the authority to adopt its own procedural rules and removes that authority from the assistant director of the employment division.
Also says you don't have to conform to any rules of evidence.
Correct.
Why do you want to do that? Shouldn't you at least conform to APA rules?
The Employment Appeals Board is exempt from very much of the Administrative Procedures Act. And this is done because there are some areas where federal law does not necessarily in all instances comply with.
Well, how are you operating now? Are you on your rules? The division's making your rules? And
well,
usually there's some kind of rules of evidence, even in their lax, you know, not standard direct to court rules.
We request the certain rules, and the division has been very good about.
But what are your rules of evidence been?
We have no administrative rules regarding evidence. We use the common rules of evidence currently.
But what do you mean common rules?
Well, the
APA standards or?
Yes, primarily.
So why do you want to get out from under APA rules of evidence? Those are all sort of basic fairness standards.
Now, are you asking me why the Employment Appeals Board is exempt from some of the...
Well, what you're asking is to pass a bill that you're not subject to the common law rules of evidence, statutory rules of evidence, or any other technical rules of procedure.
Well, that is not a change in the law, Madam Chair. It's
well, it's in boldface, so it looks like a change.
Well, it's carried over from another section. If I may, I'll get the current statute out.
Well, I think what we're going to have to do is I think we're going to have to carry this bill over because we're now going to have to adjourn because the Senate session is beginning. Cheyenne, when do we have another date we could put this bill on?
Monday.
Okay, we're going to have to carry this over until Monday. So,
Madam Chair, one quick
question. Yes, Senator Howe.
Section 9, lines 8 to 11, is there anything in this section that would be on the appointments of pro tem or that you could change the statutory requirements of representative from labor, representative from employers, representative at large. By the appointment?
We're assuming, Senator Hobb, that you'd follow the same rules on these appointments as for the regular appointees. In other words, if the labor man was vacant, his position had to be filled, you'd have somebody representing labor, same thing with management.
Well, and if I may, Senator Hobb, Tom O'Connell again, the statute as it exists requires the governor to give due consideration to the interests of labor industry and the public. It does not require that an advocate of those interests be appointed.
Okay, we're also going to carry House Bill 2220 over until Monday, and then also 2651 and 2653 for work session. Sorry we couldn't get through more.
This one will be again when then?
Monday, 8 o'clock. Okay. We'll have to, what, were we supposed to rescind one of these?
Well, it's 2643.
That one we passed out
in the Senate Committee on Labor and Tenement 5.